I'm Barbara Schroeder, and now, Episode 5 of Bad, Bad Thing. So picture this scene, a cold, blustery evening, a small, cozy neighborhood wine bar. Mark Girardo and Meredith Sullivan are at a table for two, enjoying their favorite red wine and reveling in each other's company. And then, Jennaire Girardo comes barreling through the door. She approaches the table and leans in to Meredith, whispering something in her ear. Meredith doesn't react at all, just sits perfectly still. Jennaire then turns to Mark, and in a voice so loud everyone in the bar can hear, tells Mark, "Come home now." Mark says firmly, "He'll be home when he's done." Jennaire turns around and leaves. Mark asks Meredith if she's okay, and she says yes, but she's shaking when she tells Mark what Jennaire said to her. "There's a special place in hell for women like you." Mark leaves a few minutes later, and Meredith stays behind to calm down for a little bit. The bartender offers her a free drink, and he tells Meredith she should get a restraining order against that woman who seemed unhinged.
That was the only time they met in person?
Yes. And after that, I just said, this is getting out of control. I got to do something.
Mark's version of doing something was to try and calm everyone down. He told Jennaire to leave Meredith alone. And then he asked Meredith not to get the restraining order she'd been looking into. He explained that if Jennaire had that on her record, it would be harder for her to get a job and support herself. Meredith reluctantly agreed not to file. Jennaire was no fool. She realized her marriage was doomed. So she started researching divorce attorneys. She wanted to be prepared in case Mark was going to, in her words, bring the hammer down on her. She told Mark he should get his own attorney. But here it was, the beginning of April, and he still hadn't decided yet if he even wanted a divorce. Meanwhile, Jennaire continued preparing for the worst, and she hired a divorce coach, Sheila Brennan.
So the first time I saw her, I see people not at their best, generally, people going through divorce. So the first time I saw her, I thought she was distraught, but I thought she wasn't crying or she wasn't emotional that way. She was very focused. At that point, when I saw her, which was, I believe April 1st was our first meeting face-to-face, and at that point, Mark had already admitted to her that he was having an affair. She was really, really sad about ending their 24-year marriage. She was very concerned about what was she going to do, what was going to happen to her. Concerned about being a bag lady, which, again, that's a normal response.
Jennaire was also concerned about losing Mark's health insurance. So she started booking appointments with an eye doctor, a dentist, and even a surgeon to finally get her painful fibroids removed. And it's right around this time when she's making all these appointments in early April that Jennaire stops recording herself and she starts writing this letter.
Guys, I'm not going to write that letter. The kind that looks back on our lives together and great memories and how much I'm sorry for doing these things. I'm sorry if you need it.
I lived a lie this entire marriage. I feel so foolish for devoting my entire self to it now. I'm here now because I was so stupid in love and careless with my own life. And I have nothing left to give. I just want to be gone. Clean slate.
Jennaire kept adding to this letter every few days. She would end up emailing it to her family.
This uphill road trying to just survive and heal and even assume I will find a great love again is bullshit. I don't have a chance in hell. We all know what happens to older wives. They hardly ever get their lives even close to what they once had and usually live a lonely life. There's no great love that comes afterwards. And I don't have kids or grandkids to get lost into. I am so ugly and old. I look so bad for my age. I look like an old wrinkly lady. No amount of exercise or eating right is going to help that. I'm so ugly and unattractive. I can't stand looking at myself in the mirror. I can't blame Mark for running away because I look like shit. I see the future and it's bleak. I have been broken and cannot be repaired.
I wouldn't even ask for your forgiveness.
Just know that I'm sorry to make you sad, and you have to go through what's next.
After continuing pressure from both Janair and Meredith now, Mark finally made an appointment with a divorce attorney. On April 7th of 2018, he walked into the first meeting, still not sure he even wanted a divorce.
And when I went to go have an initial consultation and I told her everything that was playing out and everything that had started from the very beginning, she was just, my attorney couldn't believe the listening devices, the GPS devices, all the things that she had been doing. I'm sorry, I didn't know about the GPS devices at that time, just yeah. about the listening devices. And she said, you need to get out of this. This is not, you're not safe. And I discounted her warning saying, Janair's not violent. She wouldn't do anything. I'm fine. I'm going to stay in this. She said, you can't put this back together again. You can't. This marriage is beyond. And look at all the things that she's done. Look what you've done. And the trust is just gone. And she convinced me that you're right. And I needed to file for a petition for divorce.
As soon as Mark left the attorney's office, he called Meredith with the news that he was actually going to file for divorce in early May, as soon as he met Delaware's 6-month residency requirement. Meredith was thrilled. Next, Mark called his friend Mike.
I was so glad that he had finally made the decision to, sounds cold, but be done with Janair. And I was happy for him, and I was happy that he was beyond to the next stage in his life.
Mark then went to a jewelry store to pick out and order a promise ring for Meredith. It was a silver filigree band with tiny diamonds braided throughout. He planned to give her the ring as soon as it was ready, sometime in mid-May.
Meredith and I never made any formal commitment to one another. We just wanted the opportunity to date and to figure out if our feelings were what we thought they were. So there was no definitive plan to be with Meredith. I was going to move out, she was moving out, and we were going to explore a life together, but independently. You know, I was going to live on my own and have my own job, and she would have her own in a different place, and we would just explore it.
Mark still had to break the news that he was going to file for divorce to Janair.
Shortly after I met with my attorney, the next day, after I told Janair that I was going to be filing a petition for divorce, she seemed to come to terms with it rather quickly. She was really upset at first.
4/8/18, Mark found me crying on the floor, asked how long I was like that, and basically kicked me out by standing there so he could use the shower. As soon as I got out, he stripped his clothes to get in, like, are you done? He barely feels bad for me, even though he sees the raw pain I'm in. He did this to me. He has no regard for my life, our history. I don't think he ever loved me. He sees me in this sad state and doesn't even care.
And the next morning, she came back with a list of demands, if you will, requirements for how we were going to play this out. And she called it the wind-down period.
From what I knew of it was that, from Janair, was that she set up a calendar, and then he had to put in the calendar when he was scheduled to be with Meredith. And I thought that was crazy.
And he agreed to that. That's kind of
unusual. He agreed to that. I thought that was crazy talk, too. I just thought that would be almost like fuel to the fire.
Were you uncomfortable having to tell her stuff, like when you were seeing Meredith?
It was a very uncomfortable situation, but I was just trying to have an amicable end. It was weeks to go until our lease was up and until we were going to file for a petition for divorce. And so I thought, if I can give her a soft landing and you know, go to dinner with her and go have walks with her and try to live a normal life, an amicable life, the last few weeks, then I was more than willing to do that. I didn't think her demands were all that out of the ordinary. In hindsight, I do. But I just fell along with it because that's what I've always done.
Here's Dr. Ramani Durvasula again.
Mark's sort of psychological organization seemed to be to enable, to give in, to capitulate to whatever was happening in a relationship. He's so conflict-averse that when people are too conflict-averse, they're afraid of arguments, they're afraid of conflict, they're afraid of other person's rage, which is not abnormal. Nobody likes rage. That they end up giving in, and that giving in is enabling.
Mark assumed that Jenner was no longer recording or tracking him since she knew all about the affair and the divorce was imminent. But of course, Jenner never stopped. And so she could listen in to all the planning that Mark and Meredith were doing for their future.
He spent the entire day fawning over her, and they spent all day texting back and forth about how they wanted to be together and loved each other. They couldn't keep their virtual hands off of each other. They spent all day talking about their future and how it was so real in less than 40 days. They talked about how excited they were to be free to kiss in public and spend every day and night together, massaging and touching and making love and being together and playing house and going out and being there each and every day. Talking about how he never had anyone in his life that was so supportive and wonderful and fulfilling as her, and he could barely contain his excitement to start his new chapter in his life.
Jenner had actually seen on her GPS tracking app that Mark had been parked next to a jewelry store at the mall. She couldn't wait to tell Sheila, who was astonished that Jenner was still spying on her husband.
So my point to her is, why do you keep doing this? Because
why do you keep
following him and recording him? She wanted to find out if Mark was still telling her the truth. So that was really important to her, that whatever he said to her regarding the end of their marriage, the dates around the end of their marriage, that he was abiding by his promise to her. I just thought that was making it, pouring salt in the wound every time she would listen to those hours and hours of tapes.
At the time of writing this, I'm not emotional, maybe angry. I keep coming back to write on future days, so it fluctuates. Sorry, it's all over the place. I want justice. I deserve respect. I want control over this shithole he's making. I need to take matters into my own hands. Oh, and he did go to Jared and buy her a ring. She kept pressing him with, I've been researching rings and I don't want to spend $1,000 for an emerald. Wait till she gets a $600 ring and is so disappointed. He sucks and has no taste at all for jewelry. She'll be all, oh, he could have gotten a much nicer ring at Costco or Walmart for that money.
With the divorce looming now, Jenner began obsessing about her financial future without Mark's income. She wanted a 50-50 alimony deal. Mark thought 60-40, his favor, was more than fair.
Mark has become quite defiant and acrimonious, and you're violent in his attempt to be with Meredith and start his life with her. He hates me that much now and is becoming so mean. He's now calling me a lazy freeloader with no intention of getting a job and taking full advantage of him. The alimony discussion turns him into a violent freak. He's going to screw me.
Jenner would constantly think the worst case scenario something was going to happen. She was absolutely convinced that I was going to leave her high and dry, and she was going to be, as she would tell her divorce coach, I'm going to be a bag lady. And Mark's going to get married, and he's going to have kids, and they're going to be happy. So the extreme of what was going to happen is what she convinced herself was actually true.
And she also was concerned that Mark wasn't going to support her, and that I told her that's not how it works. And she hadn't worked for, I think, a little bit over a year, and she had just relocated to Delaware, so that's expected that she wouldn't have gotten a job that quickly when you move in December. You haven't had a job for 4 months, so not a big deal. But she really was concerned that Mark would look badly on her for being a freeloader.
What was your plan on that?
You know, I always said, you're going to be okay, even if you don't get a job right away, I'm going to continue to pay the bills. It's not going to be an issue. And so, yeah, I definitely wanted her to land on her feet in a better place than she was. And that's what I wanted for her, to find a new her and a sense of independence too, because she had wrapped her whole heart and life around me. And it's not what I wanted. I wanted a partnership. And I think I hoped that she could find her way and be happy again.
It continues every day, the same withering, decapitating pain over and over. No amount of talking or therapy or depression meds or wine, praying or support of friends or family or colleagues can help. It's like I'm being twisted together like dough and then unraveled, then twisted every day.
Like, it really was just talking her off the ledge a lot about how it's not going to happen that way, and it's not, you know, that you have the ability to make plans. Like, this is a new chapter for you, and I know it's tragic, and but you still, it's an opportunity for you. She didn't want to hear it, and I understand that, because people are in such a difficult mental state, and I kept trying to encourage her to see that. Like, I understand when you're going through a divorce, it's very hard, but a little bit, like, it will get better. It's not going to stay like this forever.
She couldn't hear that.
She couldn't hear that.
I'm not going to fall for this potential unknown life will be better bullshit. I'm being realistic. This is it, people. Sorry, get over it. See how that feels? Telling someone how to feel? Get over it, Janair. He doesn't love you anymore. Move on. It'll get better in time. You'll find another love. You're a smart, attractive woman. You'll be okay. You deserve better.
What did she need when she came to
see you? I strongly suggested that she get a job, that she do anything. Just, and it wasn't even about, you know, getting your resume out, go out and do something, because I felt like it would be beneficial for her to have structure in her day so that she wasn't staying up all night plotting and planning and listening to tapes and transcribing. Every time I talked to her, I said, you know, have you looked anywhere? Have you looked for a job at all? Because she definitely was employable. She really was a lovely woman. She really was, from what I saw. And I saw her almost till the very end, so.
We need to take a break here. And after, you'll hear Janair explain why she's really unable to leave Mark. That's coming up.
How can I continue to love such a shit person? Well, you know what? I don't want anyone else. He's my person, my soulmate. I can't possibly open my heart and soul to someone else. I don't want a shitty future clawing my way back to some level of comfortable existence. I am nothing. I am nothing. You cannot fix nothing. I'm not even a shell of the person I was. I used to be able to balance all this shit. I used to be a confident, assertive, decisive woman. He took the best years of my life. As much as these selfish assholes of excuses of human turds deserve each other, I need justice for my pain and destruction. Their immoral, unethical, and cruel actions have consequences. Mark and Meredith cannot get away with this.
Sometime around the second week of April, there was a sudden, dramatic shift in Janair's attitude about the divorce. Both Mark and Sheila noticed it. Janair seemed calmer. She had stopped arguing about alimony, and she even asked Mark to help her write up a new resume. So he spent an entire afternoon helping her, relieved that she was going to be looking for a job, and seemed to be doing okay.
I think Janair came to terms with the fact that they would get divorced. She talked about where she wanted to go and live. Should she go back to Indiana? Should she go back to South Carolina? Because she couldn't possibly stay around Delaware, Philadelphia area, because she wouldn't want to run into them. So I used to talk to her a lot about, again, like, this is your opportunity for a new chapter.
Did you feel like you were talking to somebody who was listening, or somebody who was just, and you're like, okay, yeah, fine, but I'm going to do what I want to do?
So
was she receptive?
I thought that Janair was very receptive until after I learned that she wasn't.
So there's also the sense of, does a person become preternaturally calm before they know they're going to perpetrate something? So in Janair's case, when the magnitude of what was happening became clear to her, and that there was nothing she was going to be able to do to thwart it, at that point, it was almost like she could have clearly identified what the enemy is. And I don't even say who, I say what. It's the dissolution of her marriage. It's the betrayal by Mark. It's the loss of justice. It's the revalidation that she is a victim. And it's the presence of Meredith, okay? So that this is it, this is happening, and I need to address this. So there's a calmness Because now it's very clear what needs to be done. There's no longer that uncertainty and that ambiguity of maybe my marriage is going to work out. Maybe Mark's going to come back.
I need to make my own justice. It's the only way to set me free of this pain. It really is. He did this to me. He cannot get away with this unspeakable treatment. He is so inhumane that he deserves to be hurt in return. He cannot have a beautiful, exciting future and life with her at my expense.
It is interesting to me, though, for Jenner, that the loss of Meredith's job, the loss of Meredith's marriage wasn't enough. It was just simply for Jenner. The obsession was that Meredith not get Mark, and that Mark and Meredith not be happy. That was her singular focus.
She does not get to replace me. She does not get to have all the things in common and all the connected experiences that are exactly like the ones Mark and I had. He does not get to have the right to call her the loving pet names that he used to say to me. She does not get his undying love and attention and smiles and listening and encouragement, support and protection when he should have given that to me. He does not get to be loved and sexually fulfilled by her when he should and could have been from me. I hope his dick falls off from her skanky mess.
And the final really big brick in Jenner's picture was that she was so focused on justice. If you read her writings, it is really striking to me how often the theme of justice came up. This isn't right. It's not okay.
Mark needs to stew in his shit he created and suffer as equally as I've had to suffer. He's not allowed to be happy after hurting me and treating me the way he did. Unconditional love is a gift. He shit all over that which I gave to him. But he can't have Meredith, his true magical love meant to be. He made promises to me at our wedding, after boot camp, and throughout our marriage, and he broke them all and in fact ruined my life. He is not allowed to get away with that and be happy.
That almost obsession with justice really almost seemed to be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, and it became unendurable and something she couldn't regulate.
My spirit is gone. Don't you people understand that? I'm not worth it anymore. I have nothing to offer. Let me go. She's a parasite. A blood-sucking, life-sucking parasite, and she needs to be destroyed. It's all I can think about. I just want to blow her face off and destroy her. I want Mark to have the lasting memories of the visuals of us both like that. It's all I dream about.
Jenner now wanted to keep track of what Meredith was doing and where she was going, so she somehow managed to attach a GPS device to Meredith's convertible. In the real-time tracking app, Jenner gave Meredith's pink car icon a nickname, M. Whore.
She's a whore. She's perfectly capable of attracting nice, single men, but she gets off pursuing the married men at the wife's expense. I don't want them to get away with this as if it was an okay, natural thing to do. Mark likes to say people uncouple and divorce all the time, and that it is a normal, okay thing to do. Well, not to me, and not in the manner in which he emotionally tortured me throughout this. 6 months, I can't sleep. 6 months of this shit. I wasted my life for 6 months of this limbo shit. No, I wasted my entire life with this piece of shit child man.
There is only about a week and a half left now before Jenner will put her secret plan into action. Mark had been trying to help Meredith move into her new place, but it was tough to do because he wasn't allowed to show up at her old place because of her ex-husband, Luke Chapman. Jenner had issued a mandate, too. She didn't want to run into Mark and Meredith by accident. So she told Mark he wasn't allowed to go anywhere locally with Meredith. Meredith was not happy about that. She needed Mark now more than ever.
I want to see you again today.
So
I really want to. It's kind of neat, too. I need help with moving. I'm like, I need boxes and fucking bubble wrap, and it doesn't fit in my damn car.
Turn right onto Mermaid Boulevard.
Honey, I can help you do that. I can help you get supplies.
No, it's just like, that's the sort of stuff where it's like, it's the stupid shit that I hate it. And it's just,
what do you hate?
You're the person I want to be able to go to.
Yeah. And soon you very well, that will absolutely be the case. But even, you know, this local thing is just driving me crazy. I'm beside myself.
I don't know how it can be any other way. Like,
yeah, no, I'm not saying that it has to change. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, would you want to meet me somewhere outside of New York with Jeff?
Turn right on
Brandon Day, rather.
Mark and Meredith ended up making plans to see each other later that afternoon.
I mean, this is all so messy.
Yeah, it's very messy.
Well, I know you're going through stuff too, so I'm sorry that I'm down and putting that on you. I don't mean to.
Putting it on me, I want to hear. I care.
I know you do. And that's probably why I want to talk to you. And just to hear your voice and yeah. All right. Well, try to have a good day.
You too. Love you.
Thanks. Love you too. Bye.
She wants to be with him constantly. I told him. She's a drama queen that wants constant attention. But funnily enough, his shoulders were really hurting him and he didn't want to get off the couch and walk Huck. Because he was drunk Monday, he blurted out that she gave him a shoulder massage and it sucked, like Monica and friends. He was hinting at me giving him a massage, but I said, nope, that's your girlfriend's job now. Sorry, she sucks at it. Whatever, it doesn't change things for me. He's irrevocably broken us and me. He's been so evil to me that I can't even explain to people that they believe me.
It's now down to only about a week before the end. Mark and Janair are having a friendly conversation one night, and he reveals something astonishing to her, that he's actually insecure about his future with Meredith.
Wow, so I guess there is trouble in paradise for the loving couple. He just told me on 4/15/18 that he thinks they'll break up in a year because she'll realize what she got with him. And he said that was okay with him because it isn't about Meredith. It's about he is changing his life. Whatever, he's a fucking asshole. I wish I would never have met him or fallen in love with him. My greatest joy was loving him and making a life with him. It was a joke. I would just forgive him and keep loving him. I lost myself. I ultimately did this to myself and wasted my life. I allowed him to break me, and here I am, the ultimate nothing. Please understand, I am so done with this life. Any ramifications of my actions, spiritually or otherwise, cannot be any worse than this and how I feel now.
Janair has a few last-minute tasks she needs to accomplish. She goes to Kohl's to buy black sweatpants and a hoodie, dark running shoes, and then she visits a beauty supply store to buy a dark-haired wig. Finally, she rents a shiny black Cadillac XTS sedan. In the last few days of Janair's life, she makes yet another trip to practice at the shooting range, and she drives over to Meredith Sullivan's new house.
Oh, so on Sunday, 4/16/18, I was scoping out her house. Her house is situated weird in the back behind other houses with a long driveway and has a lot of windows that I might not be able to do it there as I wanted. I really can't hide well or surprise them without getting caught. I can't have them see me and call the police before I can do what I need to do. I may need to do a Bryn Phil Hartman if I run out of time, which sucks because Meredith needs to be erased and Mark should not get off that easy like that.
That Bryn Phil Hartman reference Janair just made was about a shocking murder-suicide that happened back in 1998 when Phil Hartman, a performer on the show Saturday Night Live, was shot by his wife, who then killed herself.
I need to make a note that they have and are continuing to make it difficult on me when they rendezvous and meet. Mark turns off his location services on his phone so I can't track him when he meets her. He also parks his car at a location far from their intended destination, and they take her car for the same purpose, so I can't record them talking. They had happy hour drinks at Harvest Restaurant, and now they're at her place. An hour now, most likely fucking, since they have the means and place and privacy to do so. Even though this morning, when I told him to wear a condom tonight, he said they're not sexually active, and that's not happening. LOL.
She didn't believe that Meredith and I were not having physical relations. She was convinced we were. Meredith and I had stopped. We were not having for months. So, yeah, our relationship was really not that physical. It was only a few times, if I can be so candid.
On Saturday, April 21st, Mark is helping Meredith move into her new place. Janair follows him in her rented Cadillac. She parks far away and gets out her binoculars. A neighbor sees a woman dressed in all black watching something across the street. She considers calling police, but then doesn't, figuring it's probably just a bird watcher. After a few hours, Janair leaves. She drives to a convenience store to buy a scratcher lottery ticket. It's not a winner. Next, she goes to the shooting range for yet another practice session. And she texts Mark about what kind of pizza he should bring home for dinner. Maybe a margarita and a Caesar salad, she suggests, as she finishes target practice.
He essentially killed me. Every positive, wonderful thing about me. Yes, this is payback. If I don't do this for myself, he'll never feel remorse. I'll never have justice.
And coming up after this break, just one more day before Janair will carry out her final plan. We'll be right back. On Sunday, April 22nd, the day before Janair is going to kill Meredith and herself, Janair buys groceries. Then she and Mark take their dog for a hike at a nearby state park. Mark is grateful their conversation is pleasant. It feels like the worst is behind them. Monday, April 23rd, the last day of Meredith Sullivan and Janair Girardo's life. Shortly after 5 a.m., Janair is up emailing her divorce coach. She has an appointment with Sheila later that afternoon. But Janair wanted to tell Sheila that she had just signed a $1,000 retainer agreement with a divorce attorney. Around 7:30 that morning, Mark Girardo leaves the apartment to go to work. He and Janair make arrangements to meet for dinner that night.
Did you have any idea that there was something that wrong with Janair that day, or were things pretty normal?
It was a pretty normal day. It was a Monday. She was sitting at her computer just as I normally left, and I said, goodbye, I love you. And we had plans to meet up for dinner that evening, and I said, see you tonight. And she just acknowledged me with a little bit of a nod. So it seemed pretty normal. I had no suspicion.
On his way to work, Mark stops at Starbucks and orders Meredith her favorite coffee drink, a grande blonde roast with extra soy. He texts her that he's bringing her coffee on his way to work. Meredith writes back, huge boyfriend points. Love you. Can't wait to see you. It's shortly after 8 a.m., which is when Janair checks her real-time GPS tracking app, and she sees Mark's car at Meredith's new house. Janair takes a screenshot and titles it, Look Who's Going to Meredith's House Today.
And then I went to work, and Janair exchanged emails all morning long, just normal stuff about, please send me your receipts for Saturday night's gas. Did the dog, did you walk him this morning? Did he do his business? And, you know, it's very normal pedestrian conversation with her. No indication that she was even upset.
Janair spends the rest of her morning calling pet stores to find prescription food for her cat, Gypsy. She emails her divorce coach to cancel their 2:30 appointment, explaining there's not much left to talk about. Janair also reminds Sheila that she's having fibroid surgery the next day and will be out recovering for a while.
She was saying, like, I won't be able to drive for a few days, and then I think what I'll do is rent a car, and on that Friday, I'll drive to South Carolina. And I remember saying, well, if you're having surgery on Tuesday, to be able to drive to South Carolina on Friday is quite an undertaking.
Back in her apartment, Janair does some laundry, cleans the kitchen, makes the bed. Then she lays out paperwork for all of her and Mark's bank accounts. Janair had always handled the couple's finances, so she writes down the account numbers and passwords for Mark. And then Janair finishes writing her last letter.
listen, I'm getting tired of trying to explain all this. It doesn't matter anymore. I hope the outcome in all of this is Meredith is extinguished as I was. I'm free of this anguish and allowed to be nothing, and Mark suffers the rest of his life as justice for what he did to me and our family. But please, if nothing else, get Gypsy. I know you will be appalled at my request, but please, as lovingly and peacefully as possible, please put her to sleep. This request is an act of love. I'm Gypsy's human, her only human. We are utterly bonded like no other creatures, and she will be beside herself without me. I cannot tolerate the thought of her being with any strangers and without me. I can't fathom her fear and loneliness missing me. Let her go out to the Rainbow Bridge to be with me. I know you will think this is an awful request and what kind of terrible person I am for putting down this healthy cat, but this really is the right thing to do in her case.
Around noon, Janair takes her gun from its hiding place in the laundry basket. She gets into the rented Cadillac. She drives over to a gourmet food shop that she'd been wanting to try and orders something for lunch. When she's finished, she drives to the firing range for one last practice session. Janair's mother calls and leaves a message about Janair's surgery for the next day. "Hi, hun, it's Mom. Just calling to see if you got everything ready for tomorrow. Give me a call. Love you."
I hope all his friends and family reject him. And this really is the point. I hope he spends the rest of his miserable life being rejected like I was. Rejected for jobs, rejected by love, rejected by friendship, rejected by his family, rejected by financial freedom, rejected by life, over and over. P.S. Gypsy, she likes unscented kitty litter. She needs her nails trimmed. Her carrier is currently in the kitchen pantry. She's
around 3 p.m. now, and Janair is on her way to Meredith's house. She stops off at a gas station to top off the gas tank of the rented Cadillac. Janair arrives at Meredith's house but parks down the street. Apparently, no one sees the dark-haired woman, dressed in all black, step up to the enclosed front porch of Meredith's duplex. Janair is able to open the aluminum porch door easily because the lock was broken. Meredith had just moved in that weekend and was going to ask the landlord to fix it. Hidden from street view now, on the covered porch, Janair approaches Meredith's front door. It's wood with glass panels. Janair breaks the glass with something. She reaches through that hole and unlocks the door, and then steps into Meredith's house and looks around. She finds a broom and a dustpan and goes back out front to clean up the broken glass. Janair heads back inside, takes out her phone, and snaps a few pictures. And then Janair waits. She knows from all her GPS monitoring that Meredith usually arrives home around 6 p.m.
I texted her at like 5:30, 5:28 exactly. I texted her, good luck tomorrow, and sent prayer hands emoji. And she texted me back, thanks. So when she sent me that text message, she had already broken into Meredith's house and was laying there in wait for Meredith to come home.
At 5:42, Meredith Sullivan posts for the last time on her Instagram. It's a beautiful photo of herself, smiling. She's on the Villanova campus, and she writes this caption: "Couldn't be more excited to be Villanova's new assistant VP for marketing and creative services. Just a week on the job, and I'm already feeling the love from hashtag Nova Nation." Around this time, Mark is waiting at a restaurant for Janair to join him for dinner.
So you're sitting in the restaurant, and you get some texts, and...
So we had agreed to meet at a restaurant not far from where I worked. It was 45 minutes from where we were living in Delaware. But she was going to be in the area. She had a meeting that afternoon with her divorce coach. And so she's going to be in the area. Let's get together for dinner and talk. So I'm sitting there waiting for her. And I said, I've got us a table outside. Can I get you a glass of Cabernet? She said, sure. And then 15 minutes go by and she sent me a text that said, I'm running late. I made a wrong turn. I said, okay, I'm going to go order food. So I ordered some food, some appetizers.
We'll never know the exact order or timing of how these next events unfolded. But most likely, this is what happened. Around 6 p.m., Meredith Sullivan arrives at her house and walks in. Janair shoots her in the face. Perhaps Janair said something, maybe she didn't. But we do know that right after she killed Meredith, Janair called a woman she'd recently met at her apartment complex and left this voicemail message. I've done a bad thing. At 6:10 p.m., while still waiting for Janair to show up at the restaurant, Mark gets what will be the last messages Janair ever sends. There are four of them. The first has a photo attached.
I got a photo from Janair. It was a pile of trash on a what appeared to be a concrete sidewalk. It was there, in the middle of the trash was a used condom.
Janair's first text after sending that photo of the condom in Meredith's trash was, I knew you fucked her.
But I recognized the content. I said, this photo is disturbing in so many ways. I thought she was outside of Meredith's, you know, on trash day going through her garbage.
Mark suddenly puts the pieces together. Janair must be at Meredith's house. He flies out of the restaurant, gets into his car, racing now to get to Meredith. His calls to her go straight to voicemail. Janair sends Mark three more final texts.
She sends me a text, and she said, you ruined my life. And then right after that, another text that said, I hope you never find happiness. And then a third text that said, bye, Mark.
After typing her husband's name for the last time, Janair points the gun at her own head.
Let me be nothing. Let me be erased to nothing. I don't matter one iota. Let me disappear into the light, dark, whatever you believe. I want to go back to the source. Let me leave this life. Extinguish that flickering flame that has no energy or light left. I am just done with it. I'm sorry for your loss, as small as it is.
At 6:30 p.m., Mark is frantically calling both Janair and Meredith, but all of his calls are going to voicemail.
And it's just a 15-minute drive from the restaurant to Meredith's house. I walked up to her door, her front door, where I had dropped off coffee to her just 10 hours before, and knocked on the door to no reply. So I went around back to knock on that door. Maybe she wasn't hearing me, I thought. And when I stepped up to the porch and I looked through the window, I saw Meredith laying face down in her kitchen. It was a warm day, the first warm day in spring, really, and I thought maybe she had passed out. I pushed in, and I went to her, and I didn't understand why, but she wouldn't rouse when I was calling her name or touching her. And so I immediately went outside. I remember when I came in, the neighbor was out on his porch, and so I called him over to help. And I said, Meredith's down. She's not responding. I need help. He called 911. He was a lot more alert than I was. And they asked him to check her pulse. And he said, no pulse. And I stood up. And I pivoted to my left. And then 10 feet away from Meredith, I saw a body of a woman, all dressed in black, laying face down as well. And it took about 5 seconds before I realized who it was, and I ran to her, and I was stroking her back and her hair. And I noticed a hole behind her ear. Didn't understand it. I yelled out to the neighbor to hurry up because my wife was in here too.
I hope this haunts him forever. Hell, I will still haunt him from beyond just because he deserves it.
I will stand over him while he sleeps all night, glaring and breathing my cold, ripe breath in his face.
In the next episode, the fallout and deep heartbreak from this tragedy. Plus, Dr. Romani reveals who she thinks is really to blame for how this story and two lives ended. That's coming up in episode 6.
Well, more breaking news now from Delaware County. Skyforce 10 was overhead just minutes after neighbors learned two people were found dead inside a mainline home here.